From WUWM Milwaukee Public Radio, this is Lake Effect. I'm Bonnie North. Today on the show, our foreign policy contributor says Vladimir Putin was playing with fire even before Russian-backed Ukraine separatists brought down a passenger plane. Then, a Milwaukee mother remembers her late son in a book that chronicles her journey through grief.
I think most people are afraid to say something. They're afraid they're going to make you feel sad. Well, you already feel sad. You know, they're not going to make you feel any worse by anything that they would say. So, you know, I just valued people acknowledging what had happened.
And the Canadian rock band The Trues returned to Milwaukee with a new album that's a mix of driving rock and roll and tuneful, almost folky ballads.
We're not switching instruments, and there's not 19 people in the band. It's still the same four guys. So I think it's really cool to be diverse on a record. I think it offers more to the listener, you know?
Lake Effect comes your way next. News is first. This is Lake Effect from Milwaukee Public Radio. I'm Bonnie North. Thanks so much for tuning in this morning. Late yesterday afternoon, Dutch investigators were finally allowed access to the Malaysian jetliner that was shot down over rebel-held territory in Ukraine. The bodies that have been recovered are being transported back to the Netherlands, where the flight originated last week. International outrage is growing, along with calls for Russian President Vladimir Putin's government to act decisively to quell the pro-Russian uprising in that part of Ukraine. Numerous reports have shown evidence that Russia provided the sophisticated anti-aircraft technology that brought the plane down. Art Sear is Lake Effect's regular foreign policy contributor. He's Clausen Professor of Political Economy and World Business at Carthage College in Kenosha. He talked with Lake Effect's Mitch Tyke about how he believes the dynamics of the conflict in Ukraine have changed in the past week.
I do believe President Putin, for all his aggressiveness and shrewdness and ruthlessness, is in a very limited situation, and it's become even more limited. It really puts the onus, and quite rightly the onus, on the rebels and also on the government in Moscow. I believe President Obama and also other senior administration spokespeople, including our UN ambassador, have quite rightly pressed this in terms of emphasizing the strong circumstantial evidence and also the behavior of the Russian president and his minions. They've really created a set of circumstances that made this possible.
Well, first, hardline as President Putin is, how much control does he really have over the situation among pro-Russian separatists?
I think that Moscow's been trying to control the situation. I think it's a terrible reversal, quite aside from the humanity and morality involved. I think in cold calculus terms, it's a terrible reversal for Putin and his government and their hopes for greater influence in Eastern Europe. Providing technology of a very sophisticated sort to very unsophisticated allies is inherently dangerous. We've certainly learned that, and the Russians have and other advanced countries have in the past. So in that sense, this is nothing new. I'm pretty confident it was a mistake. They thought they were shooting down a military aircraft. They brought down others. This is a very sophisticated system, even by modern high-tech weapons standards. It takes time to learn how to use it. And the Russians clearly outsmarted themselves by giving this to their associates. Everyone loses, and the perpetrators, I think, lose most of all.
There are comparisons one could make between this situation and the downing of the Korean Airlines jetliner from New York City to Seoul via Anchorage. I think it was 31 years ago. But in that case, it was a Soviet fighter jet that brought the plane down. Regardless, the global outrage following that incident seems very similar to what we're seeing today.
Yes, it does. And it was the predecessor Soviet regime, as you implied, that did this. There have been similar terrible accidents on our side. In the case of Russia, the Soviet Union, and dictatorships generally, there is a kind of institutional paranoia, especially, I believe, extreme dictatorships of the right or left that makes this kind of thing more likely. I'm not an expert on the downing of the Korean airliner. I do know about it. I do believe that there was more consciousness and more awareness and more cold-blooded calculation in terms of knowing what they were doing at the height of the Cold War. There is evidence that, especially concerning South Korea, South Koreans and the U.S. government have used civilian aircraft for intelligence gathering purposes. That, again, that doesn't excuse what they did. But you're quite right to raise the historical dimension.
Well, and finally along these lines, if you are a Western diplomat, what do you see as the necessary course of action? What does Russia need to do at this point?
What Russia needs to do is collaborate as clearly and openly and honestly as possible with international investigators whose access to the crash site and to the evidence has already been stymied, perhaps not entirely by design, simply by lack of sophistication and, again, the paranoia of dictatorial regimes. They've been stymied by the rebels. On a more positive note, again, without minimizing the human tragedy involved, especially for those who were killed and their relatives and friends, we are at the 100th anniversary of the outbreak of the First World War, which is an extraordinarily important example of technology on a vast scale running out of control and driving events. Germany and Austria-Hungary were the clear aggressors in that role, but nobody, including them, realized just the kind of monstrous destructive forces they were unleashing. 100 years later, we have an international community and a sense of the rule of law that's very different from the world in 1914. And that's something we should keep in mind in learning about these gruesome details.
Meanwhile, the Middle East is generating plenty of global outrage as well. The situation in Gaza continues to deteriorate, even amid more calls for a ceasefire. Both Israel and Hamas militants seem oddly content to goad each other on. Does either side have an incentive to de-escalate the situation?
Yes, I think they both do. I certainly understand and support Israel's need to defend themselves against the kind of rocket attacks they've been experiencing. It's important to keep in mind that Hamas does use human shields, and there is lots of evidence that they have been placing weapons and fighters in areas where almost unavoidably civilians, including children, are going to be killed. It's important to keep that in mind. But both sides have an incentive to de-escalate. I'm not that confident of opinion polls in less developed parts of the world, especially when there's a war going on. But there is reliable evidence, especially from the Pew Center, a very important American resource in the opinion field, that the population generally in Gaza and the Palestinian population doesn't support Hamas. Israel, for reasons of large-scale demographic trends, strategy, and I believe the attitudes of younger Israelis, Israel has to do whatever they can while protecting their security to try to minimize the war zone and war atmosphere that plagues that part of the world.
Hamas has talked about the demands they say that that this whole situation is about, opening crossings, lifting restrictions on fishing, farming, and imports and exports, and some prisoner exchange issues. How much of this situation is really about that, and how much of this is about the future existence of Israel vis-a-vis the future existence of a Palestinian state?
I think it's about both. The Israelis emphasize that technically they don't occupy Gaza. They've withdrawn, but as you indicate, they've maintained a tight air and sea blockade. The more they can relax that kind of tight noose, I think the better. I think the more that Hamas can be encouraged to work through the Egyptians, who are a reasonable intermediary and have proposed a serious ceasefire initiative that only Hamas has rejected, I think that would be a step in the right direction. It's easy to lecture from the outside, and we professors get paid to do that, and it can become counterproductive. I'm very impressed by the fact that Secretary of State John Kerry has been so enormously, almost unbelievably hardworking, and is immersing himself in the details of diplomacy. He's a very worthy successor to those American leaders who have made progress in the Middle East since the 40s, really.
You mentioned Egypt's role in this as a potential international broker of peace. Egypt has not been an especially stable place in the last few years. But would you believe Egypt is actually still in a position where it can really make a difference?
Yes. It has a very large, albeit corrupt and not always effective, but very large military. They do have an institutional continuity in the Middle East that is important. They're not my kind of democracy or yours or our listeners, but I do think that given their pivotal role and the fact that the peace treaty with Israel, which Jimmy Carter brokered, has held almost unbelievably at this point since the late 70s, I think all of that puts Egypt in an extremely important strategic position.
Neither side, neither Israel nor Hamas, is likely to win any public relations points as this situation goes on. But Israel really seems to be losing the PR war.
I don't know if that's true. I think Prime Minister Netanyahu, again, I'm on the sidelines, Prime Minister Netanyahu, who's been who's built a political career successfully on being belligerent and kind of chest-thumping and assuring his constituents constantly that he's not going to pull punches in dealing with their threats. Netanyahu was very reluctant to go in. I think the extremism of Hamas and also other groups in the popular mind, like this new notorious ISIS, I think that puts Israel in a relatively stronger position. We no longer have ridiculous UN General Assembly resolutions condemning Israel and declaring that Zionism is racism. A lot of the extremism of the Cold War, I believe, is faded.
Let's talk about the immigration crisis in this country that continues and the position that some thousands of children are in. How much of that situation do you think right now is about the situation itself, and how much of it do you think is about the midterm elections, which are just a few short months away?
Well, quite right. I think both sides are trying to exploit this politically. And here I think the Republicans are probably winning the public relations war. The way the situation has unfolded, it plays into the increasingly popular image, fair or unfair, that President Obama has been an ineffectual leader. This situation, it's important to keep in mind, is nothing new. Going back to the Bracero program, which started early in World War II in 1942, immigration from Mexico and Latin America more generally has been a very controversial subject in American politics. John McCain, speaking of aggressive politicians who build their careers successfully, going back to his first entrance into Congress now decades ago, John McCain has constantly and successfully politically emphasize the importance of immigration. So again, this is nothing new. We do have elections coming up, and we do have this very, very tragic immigration of very young children in very large numbers into this country.
Well, and of course, you say the Republicans might be winning the PR war, but at the same time, the Republican Party is kind of split over immigration. There is the Tea Party wing that is much more hardline than some other parts of the Republican Party.
That's a very good point. You're absolutely right. I think there's more clear-cut divisions on the Republican side than on the Democratic side. But both sides want to win elections, and politicians who prove durable, like Senator McCain, even though he lost the White House, politicians who actually last are those who respond to public sentiment and undeniable public geography. The rapid growth of the Latino population in the U.S. and the fact that they are increasingly inclined to vote Democratic, I think, is a reality that Republicans who are running the party over the long term are trying to address.
And finally, you are yourself just back from Europe, England to be specific. What kind of insight did you gain into the future of the European Union, at least the British participation in European politics?
Yes. Well, politicians, thank you for asking. I just finished a very enjoyable few days in London, some meetings, and Oxford Ditchley Park, a conference center, has an annual lecture that they're kind enough to invite me to. It's a good source of context for our college and for my professional work. To answer your question, the conservative Liberal Democrat government is facing major challenges. They're going to have a referendum in Scotland in September. There's a strong movement in Scotland to break away from Britain, that is, separate themselves from England and Wales. Polls indicate that that will not pass, but one never knows. And there's very powerful long-term sentiment in Scotland to break away. There's also strong and growing sentiment in the Conservative Party to withdraw from the European Union. Historically, the Conservatives and the Liberals, the predecessors of the Lib Dems, have been the strong advocates of membership in the European Union. A lot of you mentioned the Tea Party, comparisons with a very different country. Britain are not always 100%, but a lot of very right-wing Tories, conservatives, were elected in the 97 general election when a lot of established conservatives either retired or were defeated in the Labour landslide, and they're very, very hostile to the European Union. Britain has never participated in the euro, the currency, and have done just fine. If they withdraw from the common market, the open trading arena, in which they prospered, I do think it'll hurt them economically. The Prime Minister, David Cameron, has reorganized his cabinet. Anti-European politicians have been given much more senior positions, including the foreign ministry, the foreign office. So you see him, again, trying to respond and survive, in this case, in a reasonable way. I have great faith in our British friends to work their way through even very daunting problems. History has proved that. I like to educate my students about Winston Churchill. I invite every listener to learn more about this remarkable figure.
All right.
Good inspiration for all of us.
And maybe some good summer reading.
Absolutely. No shortage of literature on Winston, I can assure you.
Art Sear, thanks so much.
Thank you, Mitch. It's a pleasure.
Lake Effect foreign policy contributor Art Sear is the Clausen Distinguished Professor of Political Economy and World Business, and he's the director of the Clausen Center for World Business at Carthage College in Kenosha. He spoke with Mitch Tyke. Coming up next, a new book chronicles the loss of losing a son and the ways his family found to celebrate and honor him. Stay tuned. You're listening to Lake Effect on Milwaukee Public Radio. It's Lake Effect on WUWM. I'm Bonnie North. On a Sunday morning in February 2008, Wisconsin native Matt Monger Lynch was killed after being struck by a van during a bicycle race in Chicago. He was 29 years old. He was a chef, a cyclist, an outdoorsman, an adventurer, and he left behind his parents, his brother, a wife, and family and friends across the globe. The pain of his loss was especially deep for his mother, Barbara Monger, which she poignantly describes in her book, Riding Through Grief. But the book is also about how her family dealt with their loss by finding unique ways to honor Matt and his memory, not the least of which is the work itself. Indeed, readers will come to know who Matt really was through his mother's words. Yet Monger tells Lake Effect's Stephanie Lecce that she never intended to write it.
I didn't decide to write a book. A friend of mine, Judy Bridges, was talking to me and asked me if I were going to write something about Matt. And I said, no, I really hadn't thought of it. And this was maybe 8 or 9 months after his death. And after she asked me that, I thought, well, maybe I will write something, not with the intent of publishing it, but just for my own sake. So I started writing and I kept writing. And it was healing and it was wonderful to remember these things about Matt that I had kind of forgotten, you know, incidents from his childhood and from his teenage years. And reviewing those memories was really meaningful and helpful to me. And I think it also helped me come to terms with the stark reality of his absence. And she then told me, and so did a couple of others who read what I had written, said that they thought it would be helpful for others to read about this and that it might be healing and, you know, have some of the same benefits that it had for me when I wrote it.
Yet you emphasize this isn't a how-to book of how to get through your grief when you've experienced the loss. This is your personal experience.
That's right. And it's completely not a how-to-do-it book. And there are plenty of those. But this really isn't that at all. And I couldn't tell somebody how to do it. But this is really how I did it and how my family grieved. And I think reading about that might be of benefit to others who are experiencing grief and loss. So, I mean, if it helped just one person, I'm very happy that I went ahead and made it into a book.
Even though it's couched, obviously, in the process of your grief and in the aftermath of his loss, you really get a sense of who Matt was throughout the book. Tell us a little bit more about your son.
Well, he was a high-energy kid, and he was a high-energy adult. And I'm glad that that came through in the book. He was just a bright, shining light. And I think it says in the book something like when he walked into a room or burst into a room, you really noticed it. You noticed his energy. And I'm very glad that he found a career, which was cooking, after college, that he could put his creative energies into, and he did with full force. And I was really proud of him.
he also touched so many people. I mean, this wasn't someone who had a small group of friends. He had friends flung through all corners of the globe. Mm-hmm. Was that helpful to you when all of these people came together in the aftermath of his death?
Yes, it was really helpful. I don't think we could have gotten through it without that, because he had some great friends, and some I hadn't met until then. And I then could see why they were his friends. And, you know, some of them had that same energy that he had, and not necessarily that they were cooks. He had a wide range of friends. And, you know, I really like that he made friends with lots of people, including the Dominicans who worked in some of the kitchens where he was doing the cooking.
Was that strange for you? You know, at one point in the book, you talk about how one of his friends said to you, you knew his whole life, whereas for many of his friends, it was just a part of his life. Mm-hmm. But was it strange for you, even after his death, to meet some of these people and learn about these parts of him that you maybe didn't know about?
Yeah, well, it was some of it was surprising, and it was fun for me to know these stories. I mean, you know, of course, when a child leaves home, you don't know the full story. You get the sanitized versions. But I loved hearing the stories. You know, a number of them I've written down, and some of them came in letters from people that, you know, knew about his accident and wrote to me some memory of him. And so a couple of those are in the book, you know, some of the pretty special ones, and others were great but didn't come in time to be included in the book. And the friend who said that, it's Mary Stearns, I thought it was a wonderful comment. There was something so gratifying about it, that I knew his whole life, but I didn't know some parts of it, which was good.
Good for a mother's heart to maybe not know.
Yes.
Now, obviously, these memories were very helpful for you, it seems, in your process. But there was a point where you talked about just feeling cold, almost numb. Mm-hmm. Talk about your process of grieving. We hear so much, like you said before, about how people grieve in general, but what was your experience?
Well, it's a terrible experience, and I think our society doesn't really recognize grief, and we don't talk about death. And so when it comes upon you, you know, you don't really have a way to deal with it, I think. So, well, one of the things that helped a lot was my husband and I walked a lot, and we walked and walked and walked. And I think that was really beneficial, the physical, you know, just engagement of putting one foot forward and then the next foot and keeping on going, which is kind of a metaphor for how you have to do it.
Another thing that seemed to help you and your husband, Bill, were these two phrases that you kept repeating to each other that became almost like a mantra.
Yeah,
for
it,
you
was.
Both.
It was because we would say these two sentences over and over again. I would always say to Bill, well, how are we going to do this? And he would say, we are doing it. And so I think, you know, Bill was really a rock in this situation, and he had to be the strong person for everyone, the rest of the family. You know, I think his grieving came later, but he was able to provide that sort of strength and stability and reassurance that we needed.
How did you both avoid going down those thought paths, the whys, the how could this happen? You talked at a certain point in the book about thinking about the driver who hit Matt. How did you stop yourself from going down those roads?
Well, I think that the main thing that we did was think of positive things that we could do that would honor Matt. And that was a big help. And I don't know how we decided to do that, but one of the first of those, and this was not a happy occasion at all, but his bike team that he rode with, called the Cuttin' Crew, a few weeks after the accident, organized a ride in Chicago from a park near Matt's house to the site of the accident. And friends came from all around, and the bike team arranged to have a ghost bike, which is a white painted bike that is a symbol of someone who's been killed in a bike accident. And it's a symbol used worldwide. There are several around Milwaukee that I've seen, that was attached to a little cart. And the fellow that used to ride with Matt led this procession, pulling the cart and the bike through the streets of Chicago to the scene of the accident, where we attached the bike to a kind of a bike rack with a sign with Matt's name on it. And there was something so symbolic and important about doing that. And from there, we did other, well, some were rites and rituals that honored Matt and also that healed us at the same time. And one of those was on the anniversary of his death. We went out to Wyoming where my son Luke lives. And because Matt had done some dog sledding in northern Minnesota and absolutely loved it, we decided on that day to do a dog sled ride up through this Hoback Canyon. And it was a wonderful experience. And I think that we kind of touched Matt's spirit.
There was one project that you worked on in memory of Matt in particular that you said really had a cathartic effect on not only you, but on Luke, Matt's older brother. Tell us about that.
Well, that was a shelter for hikers that we built along with volunteers from the surrounding area who are supporters of the scenic North Country Trail, which it's a wonderful trail that starts at the Adirondack Mountains and Lake Champlain in the state of New York and extends to North Dakota, to the plains. And it connects with the Missouri River and the historic Lewis and Clark Trail. And the parts that my family and I have hiked on are in the Upper Peninsula in Michigan. So we found this spot along with a great guy who organizes the North Country Trail volunteers in that area, which is Baraga County, and found this wonderful site on the Sturgeon River. And all of these volunteers and members of our family and friends participated in building this shelter. And it's open for any hikers to come in and spend the night or just to get away from the big mosquitoes during the day. It has four bunks, and this summer, I'm going to go up there with copies of the book and put them in a metal box in the shelter so that people can either read the book there or take it with them as they go on their hike. So it was a place that Matt loved, and I think he'd love to go to this shelter. You know, my hope is that people would read this, people who are grieving, people who've lost a loved one, and say, well, hey, maybe I could do this in memory of this person, and to not end memorializing after the funeral or the service.
You describe several instances in the book where one of Matt's friends or a family member, one of your own friends, really reached out to you and your family, Matt's wife, Elizabeth, and came up with projects that really were about him, that kind of captured his spirit. Why were these instances, these attempts to reach out, helpful to you?
Well, it's so meaningful because I think most people are afraid to say something. They're afraid they're going to make you feel sad. Well, you already feel sad. You know, they're not going to make you feel any worse by anything that they would say. So, you know, I just valued people acknowledging what had happened and feeling comfortable enough to say something or to do something meaningful.
Eventually, you talk about how his older brother and his wife have a baby. Matt's wife has a child with her partner. People moving not on, but forward with their lives. Was there ever a point where you felt like you hadn't quite gotten to that point yet where you could really move forward?
Well, I think I have moved forward. I can be happy and I can have fun and participate in life. And, you know, I'm not sure I thought that was ever going to happen. And to see, you know, my son and his, now he has three children, it just makes me so happy that they're able to do that. And there's nothing like new life to, you know, just affirm the value of life and the meaning of life.
Is it a matter of finding ways each day to kind of bring Matt into that day?
Well, I think at first it was intentional. I had to, you know, I had to work at it. And I think now it's more spontaneous. I think of him every day. And various things remind me of him, looking at a plate of beautiful food or, you know, looking at the sun coming up and thinking of him paddling in a kayak across a body of water. I feel happy to have shared his life and, you know, I feel at peace with it.
Barbara Munger, thank you so much for coming in and telling us about your son, Matt.
You're welcome.
Milwaukee and Barbara Munger is the award-winning author of Riding Through Grief. It's published by Point Comfort Press, and it's now available as an ebook. Munger is also an artist and the author of Mary Knoll, Inside and Outside. She first spoke with Stephanie Lecce last month. We'll take one last break and then return with an in-studio concert and conversation with the Canadian rock band, The Trues. Stay tuned for more of Lake Effect on WUWM, Milwaukee Public Radio. It's Lake Effect on Milwaukee Public Radio. I'm Bonnie North. Thanks so much for joining us. The last time the award-winning Canadian rock band The Trues were in Milwaukee, a couple of years ago, it was January and there was a blizzard. Well, it didn't stop them from playing in our studio then, but we were happy that on this visit the weather was nicer. They arrived on the first day of Summerfest to play at the big gig for the first time. They also arrived with a brand new album, the eponymously named The Trues. The Trues are a big deal in Canada and Europe. They've gotten all kinds of gold records and won any number of awards. But the U.S. market has proved much tougher to crack, despite a great many dedicated fans on this side of the border. So landing a Summerfest slot was a big deal. So before their sound check at the Henry Meyer Festival Park, the Trues stopped by the Lake Effect studio to chat and to play some tunes from the new album, starting with an acoustic version of The Age of Miracles. Stand that I am overwhelmed by The Age of Miracles, The Trues in Lake Effect's Performance Studio. Gentlemen, welcome back. It is so great to hear and see you again.
Thanks, Bonnie.
Thanks for having us.
And this is from the new album, The Trues, self-titled. And you know, I really, really like the album. And this one feels kind of introspective a little to me. Like you guys were doing a lot of thinking between the last couple of albums. I think the last time you were here, it was Hope and Ruin you were touring.
Yeah, Hope and Ruin.
We didn't think a lot making that record.
Yeah. We drank a lot making that record.
Yeah.
You know, it's, I think, I don't really know. It's like, it's all kind of in hindsight. It's like when the record's done, you're kind of like, oh, it seems like an introspective album or not so much. I don't really, there's never that much planning that goes into it. It's just like whatever songs are sticking on the wall. You know, you're trying to write every day and the ones that come out the best tunes are the ones that stay and sometimes they have a theme between them that you're not even aware of at the time, you know.
And there it is, yeah. Because I can really in a lot of the different ones, there's a lot of like life changes and things happening, and either falling in or out of love or death or you know, change, moving on, that kind of stuff. And it seems like it's kind of through the whole thing.
Yeah, I think it's probably a lot of existential angst from constant travel, but. You know, I think it's, we don't ever really try that hard with that kind of stuff. I mean, every time we go in to try to do that, it never works out anyway. You know, we're kind of like, oh, let's go make a real rock and roll album. And it's just you end up singing what you're feeling. And sometimes that's out of your control, you know.
So. Well, lest Trues fans tremble a little bit if they haven't heard it yet. You rock pretty hard on this, too. I mean, there's definitely, it's you.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah.
There's, you know, it's a good mix. I think that the producer that we enlisted this time around, a fellow by the name of Gavin Brown, he's been well aware of our band for over a decade. You know, he's a Canadian producer and he's aware of everything we've gone through stylistically, and he's seen us play acoustic and he's seen us rock really hard electric. And I think he really wanted to sort of bring both to the forefront and represent them both in a nice way. There's two songs on the album that don't even have drums at all. And then the heavy rocking stuff is probably as heavy as we've gotten.
You talk about stylistic changes, and I think there was some interview, and I think, John Angus, it was you who said this, that even though you like to keep a consistent sound, you know, you have to change. You have to evolve in order to keep it interesting for yourselves as well as for an audience.
Yeah, well, change is life, or life is change, or, you know, yeah. It's like you mentioned all the things that you go through, like since the last record, like, there's like three kids of the band have been born, and, you know, death has happened, you know, and love has happened, and, you know, all those things happen in life to everybody. And so there's no way to keep it out of your music, you know.
And why would you want to keep it out of your music?
Yeah, I don't think it makes much sense to.
But do you see, you know, as you're going forward musically, more of the same? Because I love the fact that this album represents, as you were saying, both sides of you, the hard, hard rock side and that wonderful acoustic side, because not every band can do that.
Well, we were talking about that the other night, just about how, like, everything's so niche-oriented in the world right now, where, like, you either have to be, like, this crazy metal-heavy band or you have to be this, like, folk throwback thing. And I think it's just kind of silly. I think that bands should be able to be diverse and explore different parts of their sound, no matter how many bands are out there. It's just do it really well, you know? And not to sound jaded, but it's just, I just don't like the way music's becoming so niche right now. It's like, whatever happened to albums like Led Zeppelin 3, where it's like Immigrant Song and then Tangerine. It's like, that's on the same album by the same band, and it's amazing. It doesn't suck. It's not like you don't turn on that record and go like, I don't know, man. Like, you know, it was so heavy and then it got soft. I hate it. It's like you go on and you're like, no, it's a whole thing. It's amazing. And bands just aren't doing that anymore. Maybe because there's just so many bands, or I don't know what it is, but I like diversity on an album. And the way we keep it within the wheelhouse is I sing all the lead vocals on all the songs. So it's always going to sound like that. He plays all the lead guitars. It's like we're not switching instruments, and there's not 19 people in the band. It's still the same four guys. So I think it's really cool to be diverse on a record. I think it's, offers more to the listener, you know.
I agree. And then, not to leave Jack out of it too, but that melodic bass that just kind of like underpins everything, you know. It was so nice to hear that on the first song of the album.
Jack is the lead player in the band. Yeah. I just pretend to be the lead player.
He's the color of the music.
Yeah, and so it's so great to hear that to me is really part of your sound too.
Yeah,
you know.
Well, that's one thing that's really cool about Gavin is like he kind of recognized all of that about the band. He's like, you know, like, in order to record our band properly, you got to let kind of Jack do his thing musically with the bass, because it's not going to be your standard bass lines. You can't go and quantize them and put them on the grid and make them all like quarter notes. They have to, it's kind of like it's a color, you know? And he recognized that right away because he's a really talented, smart producer, and he kind of let us record like that. So what's cool about this album is it's done like a modern rock album, but he left the elements of what we do live. We recorded everything live, and then we, you know, we touched it up afterwards, which kind of kept it truesy enough and still modern and cool, you know.
And fresh.
And fresh.
I didn't realize you had done it live, because you can, that's what that little edge is, that difference, because it sounds really spontaneous on the album.
Well, I think the bed tracks were done in 2.5 days. Like we set out to make the record. We had all this time held, like 6 or 7 weeks at this really expensive studio in downtown Toronto. And 2.5 days in, we're like, okay, well, the drummer can go home. And so it was like we clipped along really quickly. But I think that was a function of we had done our homework as a band. Like the songwriting part was like, that was done and put to bed, which was great. It was a great relief, because then you could just focus on having fun and making the record sound spontaneous and, you know, have fun elements. When you're still trying to write while recording, I think that's hell. It's Kafkaesque.
Yes. Yes.
Kafkaesque. You've been waiting to say that.
I just learned that. I just learned that today, so I'm going to say it.
That's perfect. Well, it's a good description.
Yeah.
It's a good description of what it must be like. So, speaking of the album, let's hear something else from it. What are you going to play and tell us about it a little bit?
This is, I think, probably the first song we wrote for the record. It's a song called Permanent Love. And I recently read somewhere that a church out in Alberta was using it in their prayer service, but it wasn't meant to be a spiritual. So, you know, whatever, floats your boat. But this song's called Permanent Love.
Got away
The Trues in Lake Effects Performance Studio with Permanent Love off their brand new album, also called The Trues. And gentlemen, you've been together now, it's almost 20 years now, right? 1997?
Well, oh yeah. God. I mean, we started
kind of in high school.
It was like,
I was six.
We played in cover bands trying to get it together in a very small town for a very long time. And then we, you know, as a touring band recording original material, it's been just about a decade. I mean, we started playing when, you know, Jack didn't even know what a bass was. We just said he had to play it. And he was the youngest guy, so he got stuck with it. You know, we spent a lot of years doing that. I mean, like, I always think, like, yeah, we've known each other that long. And, you know, it wasn't really real, though. We were all in school and doing, like, one gig, you know, every few months at, like, some hall in town. But, you know, as a touring professional band, it's been since about 2001.
Well, in that time, though, you've a huge international fan base. Mm-hmm. You know, you've got really rabid fans, which are great. I mean, people are really dedicated. Yeah. Do you feel successful? Do you feel like you've achieved something here?
I think that if, you know, that's a hard thing to quantify, because if you had told us when we were starting out 15 years old or 16 years old that, you know, we'd have gold records and number one singles and number one debuting albums and fans that follow us around, like fans that have literally flown to England to see us, you know, like we probably would have said that's success. And I think that would make me happy. But as those things trickle in, you just readjust and recalibrate your definition. And then all of a sudden you want something else. You want to try for something else. And you know, I think that's the human condition or whatever that keeps people thinking that way. But so, yeah, there's certain elements that we're very grateful for, but there's lots we've yet to achieve that we keep our eye on that stuff.
Like what?
Like breaking this country.
Breaking this country.
It's been a slow grind in the States. I mean, we have certain markets that are amongst our best markets ever, like Buffalo and Watertown, New York and Rochester. Like, people are just great fans, the people that are really familiar with our material because of the bleed from Canadian radio. But we haven't had that radio success down here. And I think that, you know, so we're still a very much a foreign entity to so many people. So it's been a struggle in a lot of other places down here. That's on the to-do list for sure.
Make it happen.
Yeah.
But this new album you did differently, though. Didn't you
crowdfund this one? Pledge.
Yeah. And how did that work?
We were in between record deals, and the idea came up early in 2013. And we were kind of on the fence about it. And we met with the head of Pledge, Benji Rogers, who's turned out to be a really, really cool guy, a true believer, a good rock and roll guy, like really believed in music and believed in the fans and kind of sold it to us as the ultimate fan club experience. And we thought it'd be kind of an interesting risk to take. I mean, it could have gone either way. You know, people could have said, no way, we're not doing that. And it was overwhelmingly successful. And, you know, we had a lot of fun and got to make a record, and fans even got to sing on the records. There's like five or six tracks on the album with fans singing gang vocals because they pledged on coming into the studio to sing with us. You know, we did Skype conversations and we did house concerts. You know, it was all positive because everybody that pledged was a super fan and a really cool person. So we, you know, we certainly felt grateful for them, you know, helping us make an album, and everything's been a lot of fun.
Well, there's a song towards the end of the album. I think it's the next to the last song, the Living the Dream.
Yeah.
And one of the lyrics says, it's lonely living the dream, even when it's going your way. So do you feel like you're living the dream? And is it worth all the sacrifices that you've made to do it?
I think that song's pretty drenched in irony. I co-wrote the words with my buddy Gordy, and we always like to make it kind of funny and tongue-in-cheek.
And I think the lyric was like
lonely living in a dream.
Yeah. And it was about like somebody who's kind of walking around lost in thought all the time.
Yeah.
And what Gordy likes to do when we co-write with him is just to put a tiny twist on it that makes it
hilarious.
Something totally different. Like, it's a different statement to say it's lonely living the dream. You know, it's a completely different statement. So we kind of followed his little twist and made the rest of the lyrics about that.
Well, it's great.
It is. Yeah. And, you know, I guess it's one of those things where, like, you know, you can never really be totally happy, you know, I guess in the material world, you know, sort of the underlying message, you know.
Yeah.
You can
right.
have it all, but, you know, Tom York doesn't seem like the happiest guy on earth, or, you know, as an example, you know, but, like, you know, I think that was where we were going with it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Sure. Or it's just kind of like, you know, being in a band and having those nights where you're like, oh, cool, I like to rock, but this sucks, you know.
Yeah, I mean, that's part of the deal. I think a lot of people, you know, they think of the rock and roll life and they only think of the positive sides of it. There's the part where, like, you were sick and you have to go on anyway, or you have to cancel a concert and you have to deal with the fallout of that, or you know, something happens and, you know, well, just like today, you didn't get the right information to come here,
right.
You know, and that kind of stuff is happening all the time, and it wears on you, and you're away from home.
When it's fun. What is it?
When it's good, it's fun.
Good, it's fun.
And when it's bad, it's funny. I saw that from a movie. It was the singer for the Dandy Warhols. And it's not a band I don't really listen to, but I thought his line about the music industry was good. When it's good, it's fun. And when it's bad, it's funny. So we try to laugh a lot. And you know, you are out playing music. I mean, we're not out, like, you got to kind of keep that in perspective. You know, you can't be too melodramatic about it, or else
you're not digging dishes.
Exactly.
We're not cleaning porta potties.
You're not cleaning porta potties, which I think they probably need to do at that whole music festival.
They probably do.
But, you know, I guess if you get too dramatic about it, it really drifts into Spinal Tap pretty quick. So you got to have a really good sense of humor about it and feel grateful because you are getting to play music. I mean, no matter how many people are in the club, no matter how long it took you that day, I mean, if you're in good shape and your voice is working, you know, you can blow off a lot of steam up there screaming your lungs out. And a lot of people don't get to do that. Like, the dudes out working on the overpasses on the highway don't have an outlet. I would encourage them to pick up a guitar at the end of the day and just
wail,
because it feels good, you know. It gets a lot of angst out, you know. So, I mean, we're lucky that we have that release, for sure.
Well, don't do a Spinal Tap because we don't want Sean to blow up.
Yeah. That would be, yeah.
That would just
great,
be.
Great look. Great camera.
Great job. Good look. Stumpy.
Good look.
Yeah, that's right.
Great tall geek with glasses.
That's right. Right. So, well, what are you going to play us out with?
This is going to require a little tune-up, so we'll do a little break after we set it up. But it's a song called In the Morning, which is like a folk-leaning song, kind of like a Fleetwood Mac type of ballad. And it features a vocal performance by Serena Ryder, who's a fellow Canuck who came by the studio and sang on it and really did a great job. But she's not here, so Colin's going to sing verse two.
Okay, you're going to do both.
He's going to do both verses.
I'll just sing it. Like she's really great. She did a great job.
It's a wonderful.
And she's a big star up in, well, I think everywhere, and she's just busy, so she couldn't come on this tour to play.
But the two, your voices work together really, really well.
Yeah, she's cool.
Yeah. So
she knocked it out like in one, like I think two takes. It was
there
really
you go.
Cool. Yeah.
So well, before as we get to tune up, I want to say the truth. Thank you so much for taking time before your Summerfest gig to come in.
Yeah.
Welcome to Summerfest.
Thanks.
It's great to have you back in Milwaukee, and please stop by the next time you're in town.
Yeah, thank you for supporting us. We appreciate it. All right. Want to count it in, Janangus?
Sure. One, two, three, four.
We have to keep believing gonna be okay, 'cause if we don't, we're lost. Maybe we're lost anyway.
The Canadian band The Trues performing an acoustic version of In the Morning in Lake Effect Studio C1. The Trues are brothers Colin and John Angus McDonald, Jack Siperick, and Sean Dalton. The band was in Milwaukee last month to play at Summerfest, and they stopped by the studio then. You can hear the full versions of all three songs that they played for us, Age of Miracles, Permanent Love, and In the Morning, on our website, wuwm.com/lakeeffect. And I'm Bonnie North. Thanks again, as always, for tuning in today. We're looking forward to having you join us again tomorrow and every weekday morning at 10 for Lake Effect from listener-supported 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee Public Radio, NPR in Milwaukee. Fresh Air comes your way next. It's 11 o'clock.
I want to get too close. I want to be right there. It might all mean nothing, but I think that we're getting somewhere. You pushed everyone away.